This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. The provincial NDP leader is the first of three candidates on the program hoping to get your vote for the upcoming election. A couple of Scottish TV stars are set up in Lewisburg for their latest project. And on The Good Sentence, a Sydney bookstore is stocking their shelves more often these days because of COVID-19. These stories are coming up on the Coast. The NDP's Gary Burrell is the first of three provincial leadership hopefuls to weigh in on the issues most important to Cape Bretoners and Nova Scotians on Dialogue. He wants to be the next premier after the votes are counted on August 17th. He stopped by the Coast 89.7 studios to talk to Donnie Antle during a recent visit to the island.
So I'm here today with NDP leader, Nova Scotia NDP leader, Gary Burrell. Mr. Burrell, how are you doing today, sir?
Good. Yourself?
Oh, very well. Thank you.
Great.
So, well, the first thing I want to ask you, because this is the first time we've been able to interview anybody in person here in a while because of the pandemic, how was your pandemic experience?
Well, I think I'm like everybody else. I'm so glad to be seeing people in all three dimensions that I feel like hugging them each about five times. And as far as politics is concerned, it's great to get back to a place where we can knock on people's doors and, you know, with our masks on and step back the right distance and so on, but a person open their door and have a conversation about what's going to happen next in Nova Scotia and what it is that they're looking for. So that, I mean, that's really what politics is, thinking together with people about their lives and what they need. And there have been quite long stretches in the last year and a half when we haven't been able to do that. So it's great to be able to talk to people in the flesh again.
What do you see as the challenges of campaigning? I know we're sort of at the tail end of the pandemic, or at the very least, the light at the end of the tunnel isn't an oncoming train. How do you feel about campaigning during this pandemic?
Well, it would have been true in pre-COVID times that we would have been doing intensive visiting of voters now for months and months and months coming through the pre-election period. But it's really only been since the third wave has begun to calm down just in recent weeks that we have felt comfortable in going to people's doors. So that's really been the big difference, that the canvassing and the door-to-door visiting has been crammed up closer to the election itself.
Okay. Why don't you tell us about the candidates here in Cape Breton for the new Democratic Party?
Well, I've met with all six candidates whose constituencies are either all in or partly in the CBRM, and they're a wonderful group of candidates here in Glace Bay Dominion. We're so excited that John Morgan, the former CBRM mayor, is standing for us, and in Sydney, Madonna Doucet, and Sydney member too, is standing for us. And in the reorganized riding now of Cape Breton Centre, which is now Cape Breton Centre Whitney Pier, the NDP MLA Kendra Coombs is standing again for that office. So we're excited about all six candidates we have in all six CBRM constituencies. Barb Beaton is running in Cape Breton East, and Adriana McKinnon is running in Victoria of the Lakes. Jennifer Morrison is running in Northside Westmount. So we think it's a very, very strong and persuasive slate of candidates in the CBRM who are ready to talk in the campaign about the thing that really needs to be talked about. That is real people and their real lives and the changes that are needed to make them better.
Okay. Now, out of those names, obviously, you know, John Morgan, former mayor, Madonna Doucet, who's been sort of she's stood for election before. She's
yes.
Very community-oriented, but she's kind of a veteran. And, of course, Kendra Coombs, who is the current MLA. But there's some new faces there as well. I understand this is Barb Beaton's first time standing for the NDP.
Barb has run for municipally in the last council elections, where she did very well, and we're excited to have her standing in Cape Breton East, I think it'll be a very interesting contest there.
Excellent. So now, let's say that the NDP does get to form a government. What do you see as the priorities for the province over the next term?
Yeah, what is going to be decided in this election is really what is going to happen next in our province. So we've come through this tumultuous now 18-month period of the pandemic, and the question that's in front of us is what is going to happen next? And in my view, there are quite a number of things that have come onto our screen in Nova Scotia through COVID that we can see are in major need of improvement. I'll just mention a couple. One is mental health care. We know we're the only province in the Atlantic region where a person who's struggling with, let's say, heavy anxiety, difficult depression, is not able to make a call and be seen today or tomorrow through their public health system. We have to change that. We have to make it so that everybody is able to get the counseling, the therapy, the support, the mental health support that they need anywhere. On a same day, next day basis, not with a 3 month, 6 month, 8 month wait as it is today. And we can see how to do this because our sister provinces of the Atlantic provinces all have already moved in this direction. We know about the network of walk-in mental health clinics that can be set up and established in order to do that. And we're anxious to debate the need for this and very hopeful that we'll be able to get in a position to form a government and to get the kind of adequate mental health care that we need in Nova Scotia. That's one huge thing. Second thing, of course, that has come very much on the screen through the pandemic is the need for improvements in long-term care. And we know from all the expert reports that we simply don't have enough people working in the long-term care institutions in Nova Scotia. So in our opinion, what we need to do is across the board increase the ratios of staff to residents in the way that has been recommended by a whole series now of expert reviews on the long-term care sector. And we have to say that we have learned coming out of the pandemic that this is not something that looks after itself, that those who are living in long-term care have really borne the weight of the difficulty of the isolation of the pandemic, probably more than any other sector of society. And as we come out of the COVID time now, we in our society owe it to those residents to make the investments to see that there's enough people on the floors of every nursing home in Nova Scotia that when a resident rings that buzzer, somebody's going to be able to answer it in a timely fashion. So these are a couple of the things that have come, as I say, out of COVID, where we can see what we need to do next in Nova Scotia. And I think that's what the election needs to be about, what's going to happen next in our province.
Okay. Now, you did announce, if elected, that you would be offering or would be investing about $50 million per year over the next 3 years into the Cape Breton Regional Municipality. How do you see those funds being spent?
Well, I've reaffirmed as a part of our platform commitments for the election that an NDP government would bring forward a stimulus plan for the CBRM of $50 million a year for 3 years, while in Nova Scotia we have what we need to have, which is a major rethinking of how we fund the delivery of provincial and municipal services to Nova Scotia so that it can be done in an equitable fashion. So we know that it's not equitable now, that the citizens of the CBRM pay higher taxes and they receive lower services than the other city, the HRM of Nova Scotia. This is entirely unfair. We need to have a system that sees that this is not the case, that there are comparable levels of services in our two cities for comparable levels of taxation. And while such a system is devised in order to stabilize the fiscal situation of the CBRM, we are committed to bringing forward a stimulus plan of $50 million a year for each of the next 3 years.
Hmm. So I'm going to keep asking you about how the new Democrat government would help Cape Breton. What other shortcomings do you see here in Cape Breton, whether it be infrastructure, healthcare, jobs, attracting people back to Cape Breton? What solutions do you see to some of the problems facing Cape Breton?
Well, I think it's important to think about the economy. And we need to realize that we're at a moment in history of enormous opportunity. That the transition from the carbon-based economy to the renewable net-zero economy is one of the great investment and job-creating opportunities of the century. And we need to make sure that we are in a position to see that the investments are made in Nova Scotia so that our people are able to go in those good-paying jobs that there are in the renewable sector, in the energy efficiency sector, and in the whole decarbonization process of our economy as a whole. So we've been advocating for some time in the NDP that we need to set up a green jobs task force involved of municipalities, management, labor, economists, people from every layer of government to really map out a path for this. I think this is an opportunity that the present government has really missed. They've convened an economic growth council, but it's a business think tank. It's really more of the same. I think they have failed to grasp the scope of the opportunities that are presented to us now if we make the investments to take advantage of them. So it's really a moment where, and if we make the right decisions, this next chapter of Nova Scotia's economic story could be very exciting.
And back on the green jobs and renewables, and of course, the Rankin government did announce earlier this week that they were going to be investing, that they were putting a fairly substantial investment, a request for proposals was going out to encourage investment in green energy and green jobs, where they want to have about 10% of the province's electricity from renewables like wind and solar within a couple of years' time, and then to go completely net zero by 2030, I believe they said. What do you make of that plan?
Well, I think in this moment, when we have seen almost 500 people pass away from the heat this summer in BC. When we see across the country droughts in areas where, you know, wells failing in areas, it was never happened before. When we here in Nova Scotia in a situation the most threatened by sea level rise part of any part of Canada, climate change and a response to it, this is a matter for us of singular right now urgency. And it's not just a matter of words. So there are governments will say lots of good words about this, but you actually have to combine the words with action. Now, the way to combine the words with action in Nova Scotia first would be for us to have a greenhouse gas emissions reduction target, which is actually consistent with the United Nations call for targets, commitments that would allow us to do our share to hold global heating within 1.5 degrees within the next 9 years. The Liberal government of Nova Scotia has not done that. They have adopted a target which falls far short of that goal. I think this is the first thing we need to do to say we are very serious in Nova Scotia. We understand the depth of the threat to the planet, and we understand the sharpness with which it threatens our lives here in our own province. And we will establish a commitment to lower greenhouse gas emissions in our province by 2030 at a level which is consistent with holding global heating within 1.5 degrees. The Liberal government in Nova Scotia has refused to do this. We have, in the NDP, called on them many, many times to do this. I think this is the acid test of whether people just have words and platitudes and pontifications or whether they really mean business about addressing the climate emergency.
I'd like to move on from green energy for the moment. I personally agree, something needs to be done. And what I don't understand is why the private sector isn't jumping on this, why energy companies aren't jumping on this, because whoever solves that problem, you know, has a license to print money, basically. But moving on from that, I'd like to ask you about the childcare announcement that the Liberal Party, both the federal and provincial Liberal Party, announced earlier this week. Where they're planning on cutting childcare fees in half by the end of 2022, and then by 2026, where it'll be an average of $10 a day. What do you make of that plan?
Well, first of all, I've been to this movie before. So my children are in their 30s. The baby's going to have her 30th birthday right away. When she was small, liberal governments were coming up to elections with wonderful promises about what they were going to do with affordable, universal, accessible childcare. So I don't get too excited when liberal governments on the verge of an election make this kind of an announcement. But I do think that this is another area that the pandemic has made very clear. Where, as a society, we have to make an investment. During that first wave last year, when child care centers were closed, people's lives across Nova Scotia were thrown into a high-octane pandemonium as people had to try to juggle work and looking after the kids, as many people had to step out of their jobs, particularly women. And I think this has made apparent in a way it wasn't apparent before. Child care is not something that can be just left to an ad hoc, hodgepodge, hope for the best situation. It's something that requires a system across a province and across a country, and this requires the commitment and the interest of governments at both the provincial and national level. So I think this is a good development. I also think about the particular announcement that the government made. I do think it's important for the government to recognize at the core of dealing appropriately with the childcare struggles that we have is we have to pay early childhood educators in a way that is commensurate with their contribution to society. I was disappointed to see that the increases in early childhood educator salaries that were contemplated in the announcement made were something that's going to happen in a year's time in 2022. I think that paying early childhood educators in a way that reflects the enormous contribution they make to society and the enormous skill that is required is something that should be done as a top-flight priority immediately.
Excellent. So that's basically all my questions.
Okay. Well, I hope you can make something out of that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. No, that's my privilege. That's great. I'm glad to have the chance.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
On The Good Sentence this week, Paul McDougall talks to Allison Uma, co-owner of On Paper Books in downtown Sydney, about the upswing in print book sales during the pandemic and some popular titles for adults and young readers.
Okay, Allison, we're going to talk about books and book selling and being a bookseller downtown Sydney. And in the last couple of months, there's been a lot of data on the publishing world that's come out for the first quarter, as they call it, of the year. And it says, like data from the US and the UK, Canadian data too, says that the books, print books, have gone really, they like going, sales of them are going through the roof. Like in the US, the last quarter compared to 2020, when we're even in more of a lockdown situation, like fiction books have gone, adult fiction has increased 30% in sales. In the UK, in 2020, fiction books were up by 16%, and that was despite two big lockdowns when you couldn't even get into a bookshop. So I'm just curious what you think of that, and how does that reflect what you see as a new bookstore or owner on Charlotte Street in Sydney?
Yeah, I would say that we do get that sense. And I think that we also sort of felt that as we moved toward reaching our goal of opening a bookstore. So we opened December 1st of 2020. Because it was Christmas time, it was quite busy. A lot of people were buying books as presents. They make great presents. And we thought, January is going to come. It's going to be so slow. And it wasn't. And February was busier than January. Of course, May was not great, or April rather. But May and June have been much better. People want to read books. I think there's something about the actual artifact where when you're on your phone, like even if you're just scrolling through social media, Twitter, reading articles or whatever, it's kind of like a one-sided thing. But when you read a book, it's like a give and a take. Like, the book's giving you something and, like, interacting with something. And people, maybe especially because of lockdown, were kind of, like, looking for that experience, maybe. I don't want to, like, delve too deep into, like, what the psychological motivations are. But there is, like, something there that I see, and I hear people saying that, you know, like, it's very anecdotal, but people are like, yeah, I love books. I want to hold a book. I want to read a book. I don't want to watch Netflix all the time.
Yeah, and some people that have been writing about this stuff say that they think there's people just rediscovering a love of reading, because ebook sales have increased somewhat as well. So it's like kind of reading in general. Over the pandemic, it appears to be more people are going back to it, I guess, or other people are discovering books and different types of books. Do you think it's something like that?
I think so, and people and not only like the printed word, whether it's e in like a digital form or the printed form. There's, you know, audiobooks that people have been turning to too. So there is something about the storytelling and your own imagination, like painting the pictures for you, that is appealing to people for whatever reason it is, whether it is like not being on the screen or like, there's something about it that is just, it's good.
Some recent data that came out of the States that I was looking at says, just in the last few months, print books sales went up same time last year, $1.3 billion in the U.S.
Yeah.
That's no small amount of money.
It's not. And in Canada last year, in 2020, there was a total value of over $1 billion worth of books sold, which is about the data from BookNet Canada is 843,000 ISBNs. And 53 million units sold. And it's not just like adults that are reading. In Canada in particular, the numbers seem to trend towards young adults and like young readers too, which is very exciting, because that becomes something that you take into adulthood, you know? You develop a love for books that you seek out later in life too. I know that adults read young adult books too, but I guess I feel like it's not so much a trend as like a rediscovering, like something that we'll see over the next couple of decades. That's what
it's,
I think.
It's going to carry over.
Oh, yeah.
So then with younger people then, and with these higher numbers that tell us that this stuff is being sold, do you think it's part of the pandemic and there were other things like going to movies and concerts and that you couldn't do? So some of them are discovering reading, and like you said, it's probably going to keep on going with them.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's room in our lives for all of those things, and the return to reading has been something that has increased sort of steadily over the last couple of years, and I don't think that it's just completely pandemic related. There does seem to be an emergence of independent bookstores again, which is really exciting. As a matter of fact, since we've opened our bookstore, we've had a couple of people reach out to us and just ask, like, how did you do it? Like, give me some advice. Because people are interested in sort of like that lifestyle as well. And you see that on on TikTok too, that books aren't just something that you're reading, but they're becoming more of this lifestyle choice that people are embracing or practicing.
Really?
Kind of neat. Yeah, TikTok, book talk. That's what it is on TikTok. Hashtag book talk. It's incredible, and it's all young people, and they're all just obsessed with books, and all they do is talk about books and review books. It's incredible.
Really? And it's like, I don't do too much ticking and talking, but I understand it's only, what, 20 or 30 seconds? Short little snippets? Is that right? Is that how this works?
Yeah, it's just short little snippets. It's up to 3 minutes, a video length.
Right.
And there's also the capacity to do, like, live TikTok videos where people will just go on and talk to people who will, like, tune in and see what they're saying. But a lot of from the distributors that we work for or the reps for different publishers will often send us these lists that are TikTok book lists. And so books like Cersei, which is a really popular title right now, that's Madeline Miller who wrote that, is an incredibly popular book right now because of TikTok. It's a TikTok book.
Really? And that's just some young person reads the book, likes the book, is taken with it, and they decide they're going to tell what they think of the book, and then I guess you get a lot pile of hits. Other people like what they're seeing, and
yeah, and then other people say that they're reading the book, because a lot of TikTok is like you see something and then it's not that you mimic it, but you sort of respond. So other people will be like, I have also read that book. That book is fantastic. And it creates this sort of domino effect where it's kind of everywhere, or it's saturating the platform, and then everybody's super into reading that specific title, rather. I think it's really neat. And it's super exciting for me to watch, because I'm like, young people love books. I don't know. It's great.
Yeah, and then as like a bookseller, you get you instantly know what's becoming a popular topic, and you can probably get some copies in, and then people will come and buy them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
For me, it's something that I'm not super familiar with. I'm just sort of learning about it now, and it's emerging for me. It's really neat. And I do, like, we brought Cersei into the store, and it sold out in a couple of days.
So you're a novice TikTok book talker.
I'm a novice TikTok book talker. I just started a TikTok account yesterday. I made 2 TikToks.
Excellent.
My daughter says they're terrible, but I thought they were pretty good.
Well, there you go. So that's pretty cool. So I'd encourage some of our listeners to look that up. It's just a couple of clicks away on the internet. So I've been reading I was reading some UK stuff, and fiction in 2021 compared to the year before, it's really taken off. Adult fiction was a big category. You see this increase, as well as nonfiction, but in one of the UK, book tracker groups, they say the big story in adult fiction was actually the graphic novel format. And this is in adult fiction. They said in the first half of the past, of last year there, they went up 178.5%, 116.2 million copies sold of graphic novels. And there's one in particular, The Boy and the Mole and the Fox and the Horse. You familiar with that one?
Yeah, we had that book in during the holidays, and we've had it in every time it sells out. Right now we're sold out of that book. It is super popular. People who have come in requesting it have either read it before and really loved it, and so then they get it for gifts for people, or else they've heard about it and they really want to read it. The thing that's so fascinating about that is actually it's linked to social media too. So the author had an Instagram account and was doing these drawings and telling this larger narrative in each of their posts. And then a publisher in the UK saw it and they were like, we want to make that a book. And it's become this huge sensation.
Charles Mackesy.
Yeah.
The author.
It was all Instagram.
So that it was Instagram first, then book.
And then book.
Oh, okay. I thought, I thought maybe it was the other way around. The Instagrams were to help sell the book after the book. Well, that's really fascinating. And I watched one of those things, and he talked about it being, he said, I tried to do a kind of write the thing ageless. A 3 or 4 year old could get something out of it. Or he said, my own 80-year-old mother likes it. So is it like that?
It is. It's really beautiful. It's kind of got that, like, the Little Prince feel to it. And it does have that, you can dip into it, and you don't have to spend a lot of time with it, but you could if you wanted to. So it's one of those books that gives a lot of options to the reader, and I think that's part of the attractiveness of it. There's other graphic novels that are a little bit different than that sort of thing, but I personally think words accompanied by images are one of the best ways to tell a story, and so I think, like, hearing those numbers from you, it's pretty rad to know that people are getting into it.
Well, definitely. Well, I've been into I've been into it forever, right, from the days when it was the Batman comics, but then when Frank Miller came along, and then The Dark Knight and all that stuff, and they started to compile them all, and, you know, in like book format, and the stories were serialized, and then and then Alan Moore and all the rest of these guys, they're just fantastic storytellers, and then you've got the whole artistic component of it as well, and you can say a lot with the drawings, with dialogue, or you can say just as much without any words at all, right?
Yeah.
It's
very
done.
Powerful.
Yeah, now you practice some of this yourself.
I do, yeah, and a couple of years ago, mentioning Alan Moore, I was at the Center for Cartoon Studies in Vermont doing a week-long graphic novel workshop. And Steve Bissett, who did the artwork for Swamp Thing. Yeah, he came to the class and showed his original drawings. It was so fantastic to see, because when you're creating comics, like, something that I used to struggle with is in the creation process, I'd look at the work I love and be like, oh, how did they get that perfect line? Like, how did they establish it? How did they do these things? And then to see Steve Bissett's actual work and hold it in my hand and see that, like, he had white out all over the page, or, like, a piece of paper covering something that he redrew over top, was just very helpful to me in my own practice to be like, oh, it doesn't have to be totally perfect. You make it look that way once it's on the page. It's one of those things that maybe I shouldn't be revealing the magic of it, but it was a really cool thing to see.
Yeah, that's Saga of the Swamp Thing. It's right behind me in my office here.
Is it really?
Yeah. Oh, I think it may be a first edition of the thing, or around when it first came out. I'm not sure. That was before Alan Moore did Watchmen, correct?
I'm not sure the chronology of it, I think so. I think Swamp Thing was in, like, the late 80s,
yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the greatest graphic novels there is.
Yep.
Yeah,
it's a really fantastic format, and yeah, I know that you've been a fan for a long time, and I'm glad you are, because it's fun when people appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. Let's just talk about your store, and what do you see, like, fiction books versus nonfiction? Do you see one selling more than the other?
We sell a lot of literary fiction in the store. Mm-hmm. We also have been working pretty hard to establish a solid graphic novel section. We have a lot of drawn and quarterly titles, as well as a couple of other small independent press titles. We have some Conundrum Press, which is a Nova Scotia publishing company that also, like, publishes internationally for, like, artists internationally. I'd say, like, fiction we sell the most of, but we also sell a lot of nonfiction. So we try to have some left-leaning work, and work by people of color and queer theory and things like that, because we want to make sure that folks are not only finding the books that they want, but also rediscovering things that they maybe were curious about in terms of, like, thinking things over. And so we want those options to be there, too. And people often come in and they're like, I've never heard about this. This is really great. This is what I've been looking for. And so for me, because I work really hard doing that, it's pretty edifying. But, yeah, we're always looking for more things like that, too. There's so many books right now. Like, new books are coming out constantly. It's kind of, like, on my end, hard to keep up with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the things I was reading from I believe it was Publishers Weekly or somewhere, was talking about back catalog, like you're saying there, like some older books, and they're finding new homes now, and for whatever reason, right? Someone has maybe someone talked about it on TikTok. Who knows, right? But the book is then all of a sudden it's become like, hey, there's a big audience out here for this book, right? Or books an author wrote maybe a many years ago, but now being rediscovered, right?
Yeah, I do see that, and there's a lot of young folks that come in looking for like Sylvia Plath and Virginia Woolf and some for F. Scott Fitzgerald. There's even some James Joyce fans out there that are under 30, and it's pretty great to see.
Yeah, definitely. All those classic writers and those stories, it doesn't matter when you read them, if you're 60, 50, a lot of that stuff I read when I was under 30 myself. So it's encouraging to see that, plowed through a lot of that stuff. That's kind of when a lot of people do read it. And I think maybe when some of us start to get a little older, we think, no, who's going to want to read that? But guess what? People do. Like my son, through the pandemic, read dozens of books that I still have at home there. And, all science fiction things, Philip K. Dick books, all this kind of stuff, right? It was good then, and so a lot of that stuff is still good now.
Yeah, exactly. That's so cool.
Yeah,
I love to hear that your son was doing that.
Oh yeah, he was writing them down. I think he got through about 30.
So amazing.
Oh yeah, no, he's pretty good. And what's in fiction out there, like kind of like right now that some in the store that you have that you would. Let's say you recommend you get an adult fiction book and maybe a juvenile fiction book that you think some listeners would like.
Sure. So a novel that I finished a couple of weeks ago is called Detransition Baby, and it's by a trans woman author named Tori Peters. And it's a very interesting story. It's an ex-couple who find themselves reconnecting because one of them has impregnated their boss, and so they're looking to co-parent the baby with their ex-partner. And it takes place in New York, and it's kind of got some Sex and the City vibes, but it also has a lot of true experience and emotion and politics that I haven't really read before in a major novel. It was published by Penguin. It won a major award in the UK, actually. I think it was a Women Writers Literary Award.
Right.
Anyway, it's a totally fantastic novel, and I really recommend it to a lot of people.
Give us that title again.
It's Detransition Baby.
The Transition Baby, okay. So that's
Detransition Baby, yeah.
Yeah, that's Allison Una's pick for a book that you could go out tomorrow to On Paper Books and buy. And you got something for younger readers?
One of my favorites is The Giver, by Lois Lowry. And it is about a young boy who's been chosen to fill a very particular and special and well-regarded role in this post-apocalyptic community. And the whole world that he lives in cannot see color, and there's this special kid that's born that this young boy develops a special relationship with, and so it's a kind of a coming of age narrative, and I recommend it to adults and younger people.
And that's The Giver?
The Giver,
yeah. Okay, well there's two great picks. So I just want to switch gears for just a couple of minutes. There's lots of announcements about downtown Sydney in the last few weeks. The province ponied up $3 million, and the feds did, and it's for all this kind of development of Charlotte Street. Are you excited about all this?
I'm excited. I've been excited every day walking to work. During the lockdown, there were two cranes in Sydney. Like, that's the most crane action that downtown Sydney has seen in maybe forever, I'm not sure, historically, but it's really exciting, and so I really look forward to having the Charlotte Street just be reimagined and become more of a of a place where pedestrians can go and to see all the really great stores that are popping up, even before Charlotte Street gets all fancy, you know? People believe in the community, and I think that's just being reflected in these different ways.
No, there are things are picking up there, and summer gets people out, and there's things to see and do, and you got your store there. You also sell secondhand books, so I just want to remind our listeners that you have quite a stock of secondhand books in the back there, and then, like you had said, pretty well all kinds of new books in most categories out there, some art books, whatever, offbeat cookbook type things. Everything's in your store, so it's best for our Coast listeners just to go there and look around. Tell them Paul sent you down there, okay?
Oh, yeah. Don't say Paul sent you, because if you do, you'll have to leave. But you can just go, just pretend.
Yeah.
Don't know Paul.
Yeah, you get my special discount, right? Okay, so.
Yeah, it's cool because we're right next to a comic book store, and then a couple of stores down is Ed's bookstore.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah, no, it is. It's nice right around there. It's great, and numerous coffee shops and restaurants and just a half a block up. It's really cool now. You got two restaurants, eateries there that both have patios almost facing each other. It's like, who would have...
Yeah.
There was such a wrangling about all that years ago, being able to do that, and now the pandemic has showed, yeah, we can do that. And,
yeah.
You know, cars just drive down the street a little slower, right? No,
yeah.
I think it's all this all good stuff, and of course the whole look of the Esplanade and all that. It's really nice. So if you haven't been around downtown Sydney, come down some nice day, and when you finish off, you know, grab a book. Get On Paper Books, owned by Alison Una and Donnie Calabrese. And how about leaving us, want to leave us with one good sentence from something you've been reading lately, Alison?
Yeah, and so the sentence that I'm going to share is from a novel that came out this year called No One Is Talking About This, and it's by Patricia Lockwood, who's more well-known for her poetry. This is her first novel, and it's about a woman who becomes internet famous, and then this sort of obsession and downward spiral she has, totally, like, falling into the internet world. And so here is... And so in the novel, she's... become internet famous, and then she's traveling the world and meeting all of her fans.
Okay, give us that
and
one
so
good
here's
sentence.
The sentence.
Okay, great.
The whole park was so wet, it looked deep, like something you could dive into and end up on the other side.
If you're in Lewisburg these days, living or visiting there, you might run into a couple of popular, hardworking TV stars. Here are Scotland natives Colin McAllister and Justin Ryan talking to Dialogue's Donnie Antle about their latest project.
Before we get into, we're going to be talking about your new hotel project in Lewisburg, but before we get into that, just by way of introducing yourselves to maybe the one or two listeners that have never heard of you, as rare as that must be, I mean, you guys have a really extensive resume. I mean, you started in, what, 2008 with the million-pound property experiment?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, we're obviously Scottish, I think you can tell by the accent. And we started off making television shows for the BBC in Britain. And we were just super fortunate that other countries picked them up. You know, so we were able to work in Australia, in mainland Europe, and in Canada as well. And 14 years ago, we hoofed it over to Toronto to make a show for HGTV there called Home Heist, and which took us about 3 years to make. And we just became embedded in all things Canadian, you know. So we've been on a bit of a design journey. We've been renovating in cities. We've been renovating a lot of cottages, of second homes. We've got a book out at the moment called Escapology, that's sort of about homes that allow you to escape the city. And it seems that at last we're kind of, I don't know, practicing what we're preaching, because we've escaped the city and we've ended up in Lewisburg in Cape Breton.
Excellent. Well, we're definitely happy to have you here. But you know what occurred to me? Because obviously, you know, we've been dealing with this COVID-19 pandemic for, you know, for the past 16 months. And you guys have kept pretty busy, right? Like you know, with the TV shows, the column for the Toronto Sun, you've done guest appearances on City TV, things like that. How did the pandemic affect your lifestyles? Were you able to do everything you could?
Yeah, the pandemic for us was a really difficult journey to navigate, just as it was for so many other people. But I think we have to admit that we were fairly lucky that we emerged from the end of it relatively unscathed. But we just had to keep our head down and keep working. And what it did was it made us really think this chapter in our lives. And I think Colin and I are having a very, very early midlife crisis. And we decided that it would be fun to do something new. So we had come over to Nova Scotia maybe 2 years ago with Nova Scotia Tourism at the behest of a lovely lady called Pam. And Pam cast her spell over us, and we fell in love with Nova Scotia. And we fell in love with Cape Breton. And immediately we went back to Toronto. We started to think, wouldn't it be nice to have a cottage in Nova Scotia? So that was our initial ambition. And then that began to grow into, wouldn't it be nice to have a little bed and breakfast? And then that grew and grew and grew until we ended up buying a really large 5-acre property on a cliff face facing the Atlantic in lovely Lewisburg. Now, it's called the Point of View Suites, and it's been run by a lovely couple called Tom and Linda for 25 years. And sadly, Linda passed away within the last couple of months. And Tom had already decided, with her blessing, that it was probably the best time to sell the hotel. So we looked at it. We did online Facebook walkthroughs with the realtor to get the feel of it. And we fell in love with it. So it's got 20 bedrooms in total. It's got a beach house. It's got a couple of restaurants. It's got great scope for potential expansion. And we love it. And we hadn't intended opening it this year. Our plan was to come over here and renovate it and get it ready for the market, the rental market in 2022. But then we soon realized that there were lots of provisional bookings in there. And with tourism coming back together again and people really ambitious to travel, we simply couldn't bear. We didn't have the heart to cancel people's dreams. So we opened up. And as soon as we opened up, the bookings line went bonkers. So we've been absolutely jam-packed. We've had great response. We've got a breakfast restaurant up and running from 7:30 to 10 o'clock every day, as if we didn't already have enough work. And we're taking bookings, and everybody seems to love it.
Now, this hotel, now you're also setting up a campground there, if I understand that correctly.
Well, there actually is an RV park here already. And so we've got plans for that, you know, for 2022. And I think that's one of those things. We need to be really careful that we don't spread ourselves too thin. So at the moment, we have 16 amazing rooms. You know, and we look over the beautiful, beautiful harbor in Lewisburg. So our job is for us, imagine it's the most beautiful cake that's been created by someone else. And our job is to come and add some decor, you know, add some icing, a little bit of sprinkle on there to make it stand out. And that's what we're going to do. So we're going to create 16 amazing rooms for the market for 2022. And if we get to a point where we need more rooms, then we're going to look at what the other options could be for that. But, you know, there's so much here. There's so much potential in this site. We've met so many of the locals who love this site. It's very beloved to the people in the town. And so, you know, there's a responsibility for us to do the right thing and to bring people to Lewisburg, you know, because it seems to us that it's one of those kind of like hidden gems. You know, people obviously talk about a lot of other parts of Nova Scotia and about the Cabot Trail when it comes to Cape Breton. But not a lot of people talk about how magnificent Lewisburg is and how magnificent the Lewisburg Fortress is. So I think our job, you know, I think for the next few years, certainly, is to be cheerleaders for Lewisburg and to bring as many of you down in here as possible.
Well, that's great. We definitely appreciate that because obviously, well, I mean, the fortress is such a key part of Canadian history and such a huge point of pride for Cape Bretoners as well. But let me ask you this. Now, I understand when you guys came here, I believe you were getting rid of a settee or there was some piece of furniture you were getting rid of.
Yeah, that's such a lovely story. So when we moved here, we decided that we had to clear out some of the excess furniture.
And we thought, okay, well, it would be nice to give this furniture to somebody in the community who could benefit. So we went to the Lewisburg buy and sell site on Facebook, and we put up a picture of various things that we were selling. One of them was actually one of them was a really large wall unit, a credenza. So we said, okay, first to see it can have it, no cost, it's yours to take. Well, we had a lineup of cars, and it was just so lovely to see what happened. So the first person saw it, loved it, and took it, and we gave them it. And the person behind him in the queue was so disappointed that said, you know what, let me help you into your truck with that, because you'll really make a lovely job of giving that a new home. And that, to us, was such a nice thing to learn about the people on Cape Breton and in our little town of Lewisburg, how keen they are to help each other, even when somebody else is getting the benefit of something that they had hoped to get themselves. And that, for us, is so telling. And it gave us a really warm feel about Lewisburg. And that happened on the second day we were here. In the time that we've been here, people have come to our door with gifts of flowers and baked goods and all manner of things.
And wine.
And wine, which is obviously important to two Scottish people with a passion for alcohol. So, yeah, lots of people have come to our door, and it's just been so nice. And we've had lovely letters and emails and social media warmth and heat. It's been great, such a great adventure and such a new thing. And we have a real ambition for Point of View Suites. We're going to relaunch it in 2022, and it's going to be called North Star. And it will have, we have 16 or 20 rooms, but we also have a beautiful beach house with three great big rooms, a wonderful kitchen and three bathrooms. And that will rent independently to the main part of the hotel. But there's such scope to develop our adventure and take our dream further. So we don't know what we're going to do. We're going to add lots of extra rooms. We're going to add static Airstream trailers. We're going to build it, and people will come. We're hoping to build a whiskey bar if the licensing board approves. We might add a little spa. We're going to add a shop. We're going to reopen the Beggar's Banquet restaurant in some shape or form. And we've already opened the morning breakfast restaurant. So we're having a great time.
Sounds like it. And of course, there's no two better people to put a spin on property than you guys. I mean, you're well known for your eye. But let me ask you this, as two lads from Glasgow, have you had a chance to go out and explore sort of the Scottish heritage here on Cape Breton Island yet?
Not as yet, you know, and that's something that we need to certainly put into our diaries, because we are Scottish, you know, and we're very, very proud Scots, and that is one of the reasons, you know, that made Cape Breton so attractive to us, was just our wonderful Scottish heritage. So certainly, you know, so if there's any Scots listening and they're looking for guests for whiskey evenings, haggis tasting, you name it, we'll be there.
Excellent. Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. We'll let you get back to the work of preparing the hotel for guests, and thank you once again.
Of course, and remember, in the meantime, come on down to our breakfast restaurant, 7:30 to 10 a.m. every single morning. But just watch out for those two bad-tempered Scottish waitresses. Oh, Colleen and Ginty, they're trouble.
All right, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.